The House and Senate will both return Tuesday and stay in session through Friday if everything goes as planned. Last week in the House came back on Monday and voted to pass two bills under suspension of the rules. On Tuesday, the House passed a rule governing floor consideration of H.R. 6276, the Use It Act, and H.Res. 1065, denouncing the Biden administration's immigration policies. Then the House took up and passed H.R. 6276, the Use It Act, by a vote of 217 to 203. Then the House took up and passed H.Res. 1065, denouncing the Biden administration's immigration policies, by a vote of 226 to 193, with 14 Democrats crossing over to vote with Republicans to denounce Biden immigration policies. On Wednesday, the House took up H.R. 7521, the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, also known as the Ban TikTok Act, about which we'll talk more in a moment. The bill passed by a vote of 352 to 65, and then they were done. This week in the House will come back Tuesday with the first vote set for 6:30 p.m. At that time, the House is scheduled to consider 11 bills under suspension of the rules. On Wednesday and Thursday, the House is scheduled to consider H.R. 1121, the Protecting American Energy Production Act, H.R. 6009, the Restoring American Energy Dominance Act, H. Conres 86, expressing the sense of Congress that a carbon tax would be detrimental to the U.S. economy, H.R. 7023, the Creating Confidence in Clean Water Permitting Act, H.Res. 987, denouncing the harmful anti-American energy policies of the Biden administration, and H.R. 2023, to repeal Section 134 of the Clean Air Act relating to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And, of course, the House will likely vote on another minibus appropriations bill, about which we will speak more in a moment. Last week in the Senate came back on Monday and voted to invoke cloture on the nomination of Jasmine Heejun Yoon to be a U.S. District Judge for the Western District of Virginia. On Tuesday, the Senate voted to confirm her to that position. Then the Senate voted to invoke cloture on and then to confirm the nominations of Sunil R. Harjani to be a U.S. District Judge for the Northern District of Illinois, and Melissa R. DuBose to be a U.S. District Judge for the District of Rhode Island. Then the Senate voted to confirm the nomination of Sean Patrick Maloney to be Representative of the United States of America to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. On Thursday, the Senate voted to confirm Dennis B. Hankins to be Ambassador of the United States of America to the Republic of Haiti. Then the Senate voted to invoke cloture on the nomination of Nicole G. Berner to be a U.S. Circuit Judge for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And then they were done. This week in the Senate will return Tuesday with the first vote set for 5:30 p.m. At that time, the Senate is scheduled to proceed to a roll call vote on confirmation of Nicole G. Berner to be a U.S. Circuit Judge for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Then, based on the Majority Leader's cloture filings, I anticipate we'll see votes on the nominations of Edward Sunyol Keel to be a U.S. District Judge for the District of New Jersey, and Yumi K. Lee to be a U.S. District Judge for the Northern District of California. And, of course, I expect we'll be seeing a vote on a minibus appropriations bill, about which we'll speak more in a moment. Now, the latest on the post-McConnell contest for Senate Republican leadership. In the wake of the announcement by Senate Republican Mitch McConnell that he would be stepping down after the elections in November, the contests for the various leadership positions continue to percolate. While we've been focused on the emerging contests for the top two spots, leader and whip, last week we heard from two entrants into the contest for the number three position in the leadership, the chairmanship of the Republican Conference. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton and Iowa Senator Joni Ernst will compete against one another for the number three spot. Ernst is currently the chairwoman of the Senate Republican Policy Committee, which is the fourth-ranking position in the Senate Republican hierarchy. Cotton has been a close ally of McConnell, especially on the matter of U.S. aid to Ukraine. Since Ernst has made clear her intent to move up in the hierarchy and thereby vacate her current position, West Virginia Republican Shelley Moore Capito has taken advantage of the opportunity to announce a bid for the position Ernst hopes to vacate, the policy committee chair. There may well be other candidates who choose to enter the various contests. We'll keep our eyes out. Now, more on non-citizen voting. Stacey Abrams, the hard-left activist who ran for governor of Georgia in 2018, was beaten by more than 50,000 votes and refused to concede defeat, and then was defeated even worse when she ran again for governor in 2022, is now trying to convince a Georgia court to overturn a section of current state law that requires that citizens prove their citizenship when they register to vote. Here's the key. Georgia has been Real ID compliant for a dozen years. So when someone goes to get or renew their driver's license, they're required to show proof of citizenship. And since more than 90% of new voter registrations take place through the Georgia Department of Driver Services as a result of the National Voter Registration Act, also known as the Motor Voter Law, Georgia's verification process is smooth and seamless. But Stacey Abrams and her left-wing allies apparently don't like limiting voting only to citizens. When she ran for governor in 2018, she talked about a blue wave that would sweep her into the governor's mansion and said, quote, "That blue wave is undocumented," unquote. Now the organization she launched years ago is suing to overturn this citizenship verification process. What do they want? They want the government of Georgia, quote, "to place in active voter registration all applicants who failed to verify citizenship so long as the applicant has sworn or affirmed he or she is a U.S. citizen," unquote. Because, of course, no one who is not a U.S. citizen, like, say, for instance, someone who broke the laws of this country by entering the country illegally, would ever think to lie about their citizenship status in order to be able to register to vote in Georgia. Let's put it this way. If Stacey Abrams had her way, Jose Antonio Ibarra, the man accused of brutally murdering 22-year-old Laken Riley in Augusta, Georgia just a few weeks ago, would be able to vote in this fall's elections if he were willing to sign a piece of paper swearing he was a citizen. We'll keep an eye on this, too. Now to the Biden budget. You may have missed it last week, but Joe Biden sent his official fiscal year 2025 budget proposal to Capitol Hill last week. You may have missed it because you'd given up hope, knowing that the president's budget submission by law is supposed to be sent to Capitol Hill by the first Monday of February. And it never occurred to you that a president could be so tremendously late, 35 days late. But then you wouldn't know Joe Biden, because if you did, you'd know that this is not the first time he's been late with a budget proposal. It's the fourth. And yes, he's only had four budget proposals to send to Capitol Hill, so that's another way of saying he's been late every single time. So, if it's late, that must mean it's good, right? Wrong. The Biden budget is ridiculous, even for a campaign document. For one thing, it proposes to spend $86.6 trillion over the next decade. According to the Congressional Budget Office, deficits between 2021 and 2031 will be $5.5 trillion, or 38% higher than CBO projected when Biden first took office. Those numbers would be even worse if the Supreme Court had not struck down Biden's school loan debt assumption program as unconstitutional. Oh, but it gets worse. Under Biden's budget proposal, the national debt will grow from $33 trillion in 2023 to $52.7 trillion by 2034. And the budget proposal projects annual deficits totaling $16.3 trillion over the next decade. What happens when you borrow and borrow and borrow? Your interest costs go up. Under Biden's budget proposal, interest costs explode from $658 billion in 2023 to $1.5 trillion in 2034. In this fiscal year, we will pay $870 billion for interest. That's more for interest on our debt than we will pay for defense spending, and that will continue for the foreseeable future. Over the decade between 2025 and 2034, we'll pay $12.2 trillion worth of interest. Now to the Mayorkas impeachment trial. Last week I told you that I really expected the House impeachment managers would walk the two articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over to the Senate last week. I was wrong. They're still working on government funding, and the House wants to generate some attention for the articles of impeachment, so they held off for another week. And guess what? I expect they're going to hold off for another week and wait until they've passed the second minibus bill. That won't happen until later this week, and both houses will be going into their Easter recess for 2 weeks following this week. So I don't anticipate we'll actually see those articles of impeachment move from the House to the Senate until the second week of April. Now, more on banning TikTok. On Wednesday of last week, as its last order of business before closing up shop for the week, the House brought up and passed H.R. 7521, the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary-Controlled Apps Act, under suspension of the rules, with an overwhelming 352 votes in favor. That's because just about everyone considers TikTok a national security threat, and just about everyone is worried about all that user data being at the mercy of the Chinese Communist Party. But just because just about everyone is worried about those things doesn't mean everyone thinks H.R. 7521 is the right answer to deal with that concern. A recent poll by AP and NORC showed that while 31% of the American public supports a ban on TikTok, 35% oppose it. Some are worried about the threat to the First Amendment. Others are worried that the bill gives too much power to the President of the United States to designate a social media company as a cause for concern. The bill now goes to the Senate, where Majority Leader Schumer is not nearly as determined to pass the bill as was House Speaker Mike Johnson. Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who's shown through the course of his 13 years in the Senate that he's unconcerned with what his opponents think of him, has made clear his determination to block this bill from passage. There's also an interesting split among conservatives and Republicans on the merits of this bill. Former President Trump, while in office, threatened to move against TikTok and considered trying to ban it, but he now opposes this bill. Kellyanne Conway, who famously served as Trump's campaign manager in 2016, and in doing so became the first woman to serve as a winning campaign manager of a presidential campaign, is now lobbying against the bill on behalf of Club for Growth, which opposes the measure. FreedomWorks also opposes the measure, but Heritage Action and Americans for Prosperity support the bill. Now to the emergency supplemental, that is, foreign aid to Ukraine. It's time to start talking about discharge petitions, because Speaker Johnson is going to have to start dealing with them a week from now. A discharge petition is a procedural maneuver that lets a majority sidestep the House leadership. Let's say there's a bill that a majority of the House would support, but the Speaker and his team oppose it, so they're keeping it bottled up in committee. That's the power of the leadership in the House. But if there are members of the majority who disagree with the Speaker and are willing to work across party lines to bring a bill to the floor in opposition to the Speaker's desires, then there's a way to do that by moving a discharge petition. It's a petition that sits in the well of the House. And when 218 members sign it, they can move a bill to the floor. They discharge it from the committee where it's been holed up. Right now, there are 10 discharge petitions on various subjects waiting for signatures. Two of them deal with the matter of U.S. aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. One of them is authored by Congressman Jim McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts, who happens to be the ranking member of the Rules Committee. That discharge petition would bring to the floor the measure that passed the Senate last month. The McGovern discharge petition went live last Tuesday morning and already has the signatures of dozens of Democrats. But it probably won't get the signatures of all the Democrats because the measure it would bring to the floor contains aid to Israel. And that's a real problem for many progressive Democrats these days. That means it would only get to the floor if a significant number of Republicans decided to defy their speaker to sign the Democrats' petition. A second discharge petition, authored by Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican of Pennsylvania, would bring a different measure to the floor. Like the measure the Democrats want to bring to the floor, it would provide tens of billions of dollars of aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, but not as much. About $66 billion in aid versus $95 billion in aid. The Fitzpatrick measure is meant to draw support from at least some Republicans as well, so it includes some border security measures. But as of Sunday afternoon, it only had 14 signatures on it. Speaker Johnson is putting heavy pressure on his Republican colleagues not to sign either one of these discharge petitions. Should 218 members of Congress sign either one of these petitions, he would lose control of the floor to the majority who signed the petition, and a vote on the underlying measure would be taken within 2 days. Now, the latest on government funding. If the House and Senate do not pass a second minibus appropriations bill containing funding for the bills that cover about 70% of the government's annual funding by Friday night at midnight, the government will go into a temporary partial government shutdown. The six bills in question are the three big ones: defense, homeland security, and labor, health, and human services, along with three remaining bills, including state and foreign operations, financial services and general government, and legislative branch appropriations. Together, they'll account for about $1.2 trillion in spending in fiscal year 2024. If media reports are accurate, negotiators have come to agreement over five of the six remaining bills, but have run into problems coming to agreement on the sixth bill. That sixth bill, the problematic one, is the bill that provides funding for the Department of Homeland Security. The issue hanging up the negotiations is, not surprisingly, what to do about the crisis at the southern border. The House, run by Republicans, believes the solution is to strengthen enforcement efforts and has included additional funding for that purpose. The Senate, run by Democrats, disagrees and doesn't want to include such funds. The two sides may come to agreement by not agreeing. That is, rather than pass a funding bill for fiscal year 2024, as they've done with the other funding bills, they may choose simply to pass a full year continuing resolution for the Department of Homeland Security. The minibus was expected to be released Sunday afternoon so the House could hold to its 72-hour rule and vote on Wednesday. But as of Sunday night, no agreement had been reached and no minibus has been released. Now to the latest on the Trump indictments. On Friday morning, Georgia Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee issued his eagerly anticipated ruling, declaring that Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis could remain on the case only if she removed Special Counsel Nathan Wade, her former paramour, from the case. In allowing Willis to remain on the case, McAfee essentially declared that it was okay to lie to a judge under oath. Meanwhile, in a Manhattan courthouse last week, the judge overseeing the prosecution brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has announced his decision to delay the start of the trial until at least mid-April, after new evidence was made available in the case. That new evidence was more than 70,000 pages of records held by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, at least some of which is relevant to the Bragg case against Trump. Now to the latest on the Biden impeachment. Last Tuesday was a remarkable day in Washington as Special Counsel Robert Hur appeared before the House Judiciary Committee to answer the committee's questions about his report explaining his decision not to recommend indictment of President Joe Biden. Hur was a target of both sides. Most of the Republicans on the committee went after him for not recommending indictment, while most of the Democrats on the committee went after him for writing the things he did about Biden's mental acuity. Before we get into the actual Herr testimony, it's important to note that the Biden administration's comms people, their communications people, are really, really good at the basic blocking and tackling of the political communications business. For instance, when was the last time the White House put out bad news at any time other than a Friday afternoon, and preferably a Friday afternoon before a long holiday weekend? In this case, the Biden Justice Department knew it had to respond to a congressional subpoena demanding production of the full transcript of the 5 hours of interviews that Herr conducted directly with Biden last October, but it didn't want to draw attention to that transcript for reasons that would be obvious to anyone who takes the time to read it. So, what to do? Wait until the morning you know Herr is scheduled to go before the full Judiciary Committee and respond to the subpoena by releasing the transcript of the interview just before the hearing was set to begin. That way, you get a twofer. You get the credit from the dominant media for releasing the transcript and therefore being transparent. And you hold back the transcript long enough that you keep the committee's Republicans and staffers from having enough time to read through it and use it to formulate proper questions for Herr, who's going to be sitting right in front of you in just moments. As I said, the Biden comms people are smart. The most obvious embarrassment to the Biden administration and to Biden personally is what the transcript reveals about Herr's discussion with Biden about the timing of the death of Biden's son, Beau. Herr had written in his report that Biden had had trouble remembering the year his son had died. In the press conference Biden held on the day the Herr report was released, a press conference that was called for the express purpose of allowing Biden to dispel the notion that he was a senile old man with a faulty memory, Biden spoke angrily of Herr's questioning of Biden over Beau's death. Quote, "How the hell dare Herr raise that? Frankly, when I was asked the question," spat Biden, "I thought to myself it wasn't any of their damned business," end quote. Except the transcript reveals it wasn't Herr who introduced Biden's son's death into the conversation. It was Biden himself. In fact, Herr never asked a question about Beau's death. I've included links to the two interview transcripts, one for each day Biden sat with the special counsel, in the suggested reading, so you can read it for yourself. Now, back to Herr's testimony in front of the committee. As I said, Democrats on the committee attacked Herr for saying what he said about Biden's mental acuity. They tried to put words in Herr's mouth. For instance, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, a very progressive Democrat, declared during her questioning that the, quote, "lengthy, expensive, and independent investigation resulted in a complete exoneration of President Joe Biden," end quote. Herr retorted, quote, "I need to go back and make sure that I take note of a word that you use, exonerations. That is not a word I used in the report and not part of my task." Jayapal jumped in and spoke over him, insisting that it was her time, and continued to argue that the report exonerated Biden. Herr would have none of it, replying again, quote, "I did not exonerate him. That word does not appear in the report," end quote. At another point in the questioning by Congressman Matt Gaetz, Gaetz read an excerpt from Biden's press conference the night the Herr report was released, highlighting Biden's claim that he, quote, "did not share classified information," end quote, with his ghostwriter. Gaetz asked, quote, "That's not true, is it, Mr. Herr?" To which Herr responded, quote, "That is inconsistent with the findings based on the evidence in my report." When Gaetz smiled and called it a lie, quote, "as regular people would say," Herr laughed. Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan suggested he knew why Biden retained classified information. He knew he would write a book after he left the vice presidency, and that book would be well paid for. Wrote Special Counsel Robert Herr in his report, quote, "Finally, Mr. Biden had strong motivations to ignore the proper procedures for safeguarding the classified information in his notebooks. He decided months before leaving office to write a book and began meeting with his ghostwriter while still vice president. After his vice presidency, the notebooks continued to be an invaluable resource that he consulted liberally," end quote. Jordan pointed to that portion of the Hur report and noted that Biden had received an $8 million advance for his book. Quote, Joe Biden had 8 million reasons to break the rules, Jordan said. He took classified information and shared it with the guy who was writing the book. He knew the rules, but he broke them for $8 million in a book advance. Now to the latest on 2024. Last Tuesday, former President Donald Trump won a majority of the votes cast in Washington State's presidential primary, and with them, won all the state's Republican delegates. That put him over the top. He now has won enough delegates to capture the nomination at the convention, so he has earned for himself the title presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. As expected, once former President Trump took over the Republican National Committee by forcing the early resignation of the chairman and co-chairman of the committee and replacing them with his own chosen supporters, and then installing his own senior aides as top staffers of the committee, it didn't take long for changes to be made. New RNC chairman Michael Whatley took over on Friday, March 8th. Over the weekend, dozens of RNC staffers received emails from their superiors telling them to arrive for work on Monday morning at 8 a.m. About 60 of them were let go that morning. Now to the latest on The Jenny Beth Show. Episode 57 of The Jenny Beth Show dropped last Wednesday. It features Jenny Beth's interview with former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who worked closely with Jenny Beth in the early days of the Tea Party movement. Congresswoman Bachmann founded the Tea Party caucus in the House and was the backbone of the effort to defeat Obamacare and other leftist initiatives that came out of the Obama administration. The conversation is highly recommended. And that's our Washington report for this week.